Testing. Test.
As opposed to what you saw elsewhere. Could you say something about how television affected you personally during the Tet crisis in 1968?
Yes. In my office in the White House, there was a television set. I had a remote control device. And I worked late most evenings. And about 6:30, I would flip on the evening news as I wrote or worked. I would look up at it, and frequently I would see Vietnam. I guess I watched it from out of two points of view, one the natural one of interest in it, and another an interest in what the American people were seeing. I think probably Johnson's fascination with news, with television sets, and with wire tickers, he had two or three tickers in his office, was both a desire to know what was going on and to have a sense of what the public was learning at the same time. I think the most powerful moment of my encounter with this television set across the room, the thing that hit me the hardest, came one evening, maybe a year before Tet, when I flipped it on and saw a film of a Marine walking through a village. The Marines had cleared out the Viet Cong, but the Viet Cong had used this village as a staging area for some time, and in order to prevent that any further, the Marines set fire to it. And there was a Marine, non-com, walking through the village with his Zippo lighter, touching it to the edges of these thatch roof huts, the eaves of those huts, and they caught fire quickly. I watched it with total horror. I knew what, at least from the point of view of someone who had lived, who was alive during the Second World War and the Korean War, I had some idea what war was about. But this, the immediacy of this, the almost casual way in which this American seemed to be burning down the homes of people who were not themselves Viet Cong, affected me very deeply. I thought about it late into that evening, and the next morning I went to see Bill Moyers, which must have meant this was in 66 before he left, and told him that I thought we had to make some profound decisions about the coverage of the war. At the time, I think I was really thinking that we ought to cut it. We ought to impose censorship on the war. I assumed that this sort of thing would have to be done, that we would burn down villages in order to get the VC out. And I thought it was so degrading and depressing that to show it on evening television as people sat down to dinner would destroy the war effort. Either that, or we had to stop burning down people's houses, and that the choice seemed to be pretty clear.
All right. Now, you got that, Joe, didn't you? Okay. I'd say in that case, what you did is just fine. I think I'll get you to hand me the book so you won't be tempted to scratch it, because okay, we'll get that on the Niagara. But let's see. Have we got...
Ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you want this on film?
I'd say not, no. Okay. You might want to get just a little bit of it, but... No, I guess not, because... Well, the opening we would use anyway, I'm sure, this opening. So let's get the first part, the first two, three sentences.
You rolling, Joe?
Yes.
Shall
okay,
I go?
Let me slate it. Scene one, take one.
the president had excised a long section of his 1968 State of the Union address, which dealt with Vietnam. He preferred to reserve the subject for a later occasion, and he instructed me to prepare a draft. After Tet, the need seemed greater than ever, but so was the confusion about what to do. There was a baffling disparity between reports from MACV, that was our headquarters in Vietnam, and the stories that dominated the papers and the evening television screens. On several mornings, I arrived at the White House filled with shock and foreboding over what I had seen the night before, and I went to Walt Rostow's office to read the cables from Saigon. They were invariably optimistic, full of stratospheric enemy body counts, inspiring stories of South Vietnamese resistance, and so forth. Rostow elaborated on them. The enemy had called out his hidden agents and sympathizers, and they had been decimated. There had been no popular uprising in the cities. In the anachronistic language of pre-1940 Oxford, the South Vietnamese were suddenly, this is Rostow's language, pulling up their socks, bowing their necks, putting their shoulders to the wheel. As it happened, there was truth in the assessment that the enemy had not achieved his aims in South Vietnam. But he had convinced the American public that after all the bombing, after all our expenditure of lives and resources, he was still vitally alive, resourceful, and determined. The horrific pictures of death and destruction kept coming on the tube, making a travesty of phrases like body counts and surfaced enemy assets. As Don Oberdorfer suggested in his book on the Tet Offensive, the central event of the period, measured by its influence on public opinion, was the shooting of a bound Viet Cong suspect in a Saigon street by the chief of the National Police, General Nguyen Luan. Photographs and films of the incident were universally reproduced. In them, Americans saw not only the inhumanity of an ally, but confrontation of an impression that had been building for years. We were sunk in a war between alien peoples with whom we shared few human values.
Okay, thank you. A quotation that is Aaron Chandler on 81 and over on 82.
Okay, ready to go?
Yeah.
I felt we were being put to it as hard as we ever had, and I was extremely disturbed. I would go in two or three mornings a week and study the cable book and talk to Rostow and ask him what had happened the day before, and would get from him what almost seemed hallucinatory from the point of view of what I had seen on network television the night before. Well, I must say that I mistrusted what he said, although I don't say with any confidence that I was right to mistrust him. Because like millions of other people who had been looking at television the night before, I had the feeling that the country had just about had it, that they would simply not take any more. I suppose from a social scientist's point of view, it's particularly interesting that people like me, people who had some responsibility for expressing the presidential point of view, could be so affected by the media as everyone else was, while downstairs, within 50 yards of my desk, was that enormous panoply of intelligence gathering devices, tickers, radios, messages coming in from the field. I assume the reason this is so, the reason I put aside my own interior access to confidential information and was more persuaded by what I saw on the tube and in the newspapers, was that like everyone else who had been deeply involved in explaining the policies of the war and trying to understand them and render some judgment, I was fed up with the light at the end of the tunnel stuff. I was fed up with the optimism that seemed to flow without stopping from Saigon.
All right, fine, thank you. Harry, I'd like you to say something about the impact of the General Luan photograph and news film, and say something about when you first saw it and what its impact was to you.
Well, I must have seen it the first night it was shown on television in the States. It hit me as very hard, and I remember being impressed in some way by the fact that it was shown twice. It was in the same newscast that they showed it, described what we were seeing, and then went back and showed it again, which was most unusual for any television. And this seemed to be saying, watch this, this is important. I was dismayed. I had known Luan. I had known him. I had met him in Saigon in May of 1967, about 6 months earlier. He showed up one night looking rather like a mischievous, wild dog. He came to a dinner at which there were General Abrams and myself and another man, another American, and a number of Vietnamese in the government. And he was treated as a kind of raffish scoundrel by the American I was with. And here he was, blowing somebody's brains out on the streets of Saigon. And I guess I felt that this was proof that we were backing a regime without scruples. Proof, too, that we were involved up to our necks in a war between alien cultures, alien to us, in which we had very little in common. You may recall during the Vietnam period when, at least early on, the common expression from people that this was that Asians did not have the same, did not place the same value on life that we did. Therefore, it was not surprising that they would kill any number of people or cause any number of people to die. It didn't really matter to them. But that began to, excuse or rationalization began to pall after a while. It and one felt simply that we shouldn't be there. In those days, I have difficulty as I look back on these things in separating what I felt from as a citizen, as a person observing these events on television, and what I felt as a close advisor and employee of President Johnson's, and very much involved in the war effort. I was I had running in me, I guess, ideologically, the two elements of being of a Cold Warrior and of someone who felt that Vietnam was the wrong place to fight any kind of war for us. I had friends on both sides and had had ever since 1961 when our first involvement, as a matter of fact, much earlier, 1952, when I was an officer in the Air Force and I briefed people on the kind of war that was going on with the Viet Minh. I'd been much involved. Vietnam had seemed like a climate of life to me. But I was essentially supportive of the war effort at the time. By the time I went to the White House in 1965, and these events shown on television, this reality as I saw it, the reality of death and of destruction, of a casual death on the streets of Saigon, all that had an enormous impact, not only personally, but also politically, in the sense of what it meant to the public.
All right, thank you. Now what I'd like to do, I know you're getting sick and tired of this, but I'd like to roll a camera and ask you that same question.
I'll try to give a shorter answer.
But again, what you've added is extremely helpful to me because this touches on things, again, that we are very interested in. But what I would like you to address directly for the camera will be the question, which I'll roll in a second again, of the specifically the General Luan photograph and what impact it had on you.
Okay.
And I think if you...
Should I say I met him? Should I say I met him? Is that?
I think that's very helpful, yeah. Okay. But I'd move from the reference about the Oriental does not value human life to that photograph, because that slogan is one that a lot of Americans are familiar with and were at the time.
Yeah.
So let's roll the section
again. David, can you put your chair over here?
Sure.
I think the lighting will be better if you look on this side of the camera than on the other side.
Yeah. Yeah, this looks better to me, Harry, because...
Take two, take one.
I think you can speak naturally without there being a problem. All right. Harry, I'd like you to discuss the impact of the General Low on Execution photograph and news film on you personally and its impact on Tet. And in the beginning of your answer, please, if you will, refer to the subject of Low on and the photograph.
The photograph and the film footage on TV of General Loewen walking up to a suspected VC on the streets of Saigon and blowing his brains out had an enormous impact on me, as I think it did on people generally. I'd met Loewen the year before in Saigon. He came to a dinner where I was with a friend and with General Abrams. He was the police chief of Saigon at the time. And he was a small, mischievous-looking man, had a sort of a raffish animal-like quality to him. When I saw him do this, it did not altogether surprise me. I'd heard he was a brutal fellow, though I must say I'd also heard that he was rather less corrupt than many Vietnamese generals. I saw that event on the screen and in the newspapers with two powerful impressions. One was one that simply hit me as a citizen and a person watching something that seemed at the same time to demonstrate the Oriental's lack of concern for human life, which is we'd heard a lot about when there were mass deaths in Vietnam, and at the same time to tell me that we were involved up to our necks in a war among very alien people with whom we shared few values. There was that feeling as a citizen, and there was another feeling that I felt as I watched it. That was the feeling of an aide to President Johnson, someone who was supportive of his efforts to end the war in an honorable way. And I knew that the impact of that footage on television on the American people would be tremendous, that it would hit them very hard, and it gave me all the more a feeling that I should do whatever I could to help us get out as quickly as possible.
Okay.
I think the public opinion swings with regard to Vietnam are still elusive in their meaning. My feeling is that Johnson was right in believing that his biggest public opinion problem with respect to Vietnam was with the Hawks. That despite the fact that people were outside chanting, "Hey, hey, LBJ," that a much larger number of Americans felt angry about Vietnam because we had not won it, because we hadn't beaten the bastards. And the vote for Gene McCarthy that was broken down by the Michigan Research Center in the presidential primary of 1968, McCarthy got 42% of that vote, a minority, but such a healthy minority that it seemed to indicate Johnson was quite vulnerable. the majority of that 42% was a what the Michigan Center defined as a hawk vote, in the sense that people despised the war and wanted it over, but not by our turning tail and running, as the expression in those days went, rather by winning it, bombing the North Vietnamese, beating them down, forcing them to sue for peace. That that feeling of an essential anger about Vietnam, but for the reasons that it wasn't being won, seems to me to be consistent with a support for the president. Of course, one also knows that in most international crises, the instinctive reaction of people, of the public, is to support the president. The public supported the President Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs, for God's sake, when it was clear that he had made a terrible boner, a very embarrassing one, and a very harmful one to our foreign policy. Public support rose because it rallies around the president, and in times of foreign trouble. And the same, I think, was true in Tet, that people would naturally support the president. But it was a corroded and corroding support. It was one that was slowly crumbling, I think, from a number of reasons, not the least of which, and perhaps as Johnson thought, was that that we weren't winning the war, that it seemed endless.
All right. Hold that for a second.
American people, the big blow of Tet, certainly to me, and I think to most other people, was that an enemy who had been pounded by every means of sophisticated and unsophisticated warfare, bombed and burned and interdicted on the way south, hit in every possible way, resisted by special forces and by main force divisions, the whole works, could still mount an enormous effort, such as the Viet Cong did and the North Vietnamese did in early 1968. And that had an immediately depressing impact on me, and I think it did on many others. There was a feeling that, my God, these people are going to keep at it forever. I didn't really feel that they had beaten us in Tet. The word was clear after two or three days that we had not fallen apart, that there weren't large elements of our resistance that had folded. But we certainly had the feeling that they were still vital, still vigorous, that even having been beaten here, they would keep at it and come right back. They seemed tireless. They seemed to care a hell of a lot more about it than we did, certainly than the average American did, who wanted mostly to get out of it. But that, I think that's the meaning. That was what Tet meant. And then the question is, what does it show on, what showed on the television and in the papers? What was the message carried there? Essentially the same message, the enemy's tremendous vitality. I think the public's response was, as usual, is to support the president and support the government, support the national entity at a time of crisis. But that behind it, I think there was behind that surface support, I think there was the feeling of despair that the war could not be. Could not be won with the effort we were making.
I think that's a fascinating response, and it seems to me it's a criticism that must be leveled of poll data. That this is one of the things that I could so easily imagine people responding to these questions about support for the war because of that perceived necessity to aid the country in time of need. Mm-hmm. But it's hard for me to see how the visual images of Tet couldn't have terribly, terribly discouraged those mm-hmm. that come right before.
Absolutely.
All right. Let's roll this on.
Scene three, take one. You get set.
Now, Harry, I'd like you to talk about the impact of Tet 68 on the American people, and I'd like you to include that in your opening.
The Tet Offensive by the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese hit all of us hard in the White House. Certainly I felt, and I think many people I talked to outside of government felt very discouraged by that offensive. Not fearful that we were going to be driven out of Vietnam by the enemy, but astounded that after all the pounding that the enemy had taken from us, all the sophisticated warfare that had been thrown at him, he could still come back. Discouraged by his vitality and by his apparent drive, and comparing that, as far as I was concerned, by the feeling on the part of most of the American public that one talked to, that this war was not worth the candle, it was not worth the tragic effort that we had made. So Tet came on and hit us with a feeling of the implacability of the enemy, that he was not going to quit. The polls shortly after Tet showed that the public supported the president, that there had been no decline in support for President Johnson. My feeling is that that's the kind of thing that happens in most crises, that the public responds instinctively by rallying around the president, as they did around President Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs, a disastrous American diplomatic defeat, but one which caused the country to respond favorably to the president, or to support him. And the same is true of Tet, I think. I think behind that immediate support that they gave to Johnson, there was a feeling of almost despair, and that this war would go on indefinitely, and that there was really nothing that we could do to carry it to a conclusion within the guidelines, within the limits that we had set for ourselves. Over in the Pentagon, about a month later, Clark Clifford would ask the chief of staff of the Army whether we could win the war with the effort that we were then making, and the answer was no. We could not. We could hang on, but not win it. And I think that the American people felt that instinctively, and Tet was a confirmation of it.